It is finally time for me to graduate from the University of Texas at Dallas. In 1 month, I'll be graduating with a master's in IT and management. That also means that I've been incredibly overwhelmed. That also means that I haven't had much time to do podcasts and the Product League podcast. However, in this episode, I'm the most excited I've been. That is because I'm interviewing one of the people I wanted to interview for a couple of months now. Well, actually, this is not an interview, but I think it's much better than that. I'll be leaving this episode in the hands of David Girelli, Global Data Products Director at CBRE. As some of you may know, I'm interning at CBRE as a product management intern for the past 10 months now, and David is my manager. I've been incredibly fortunate to learn from him over these past months, and I wanted David to join as a guest speaker at an event organized by the Product League Club and speak in front of a class with more than 60 attendees on AI, ML, and the future of product management. So for you who couldn't attend this event, here is a recording of it. Take a pen and a paper because this session was incredibly informative. A big bonus of this episode is that the session was also video recorded. If you feel like watching a video of the session instead of listening to this podcast, jump into the YouTube video. The link of the YouTube video is in the description of this episode.
Okay, let's get started. Gives me great pleasure to invite Mr. David Girelli from CBRE. He is, as you see, he's the product director. Many years of experience. Fortunate to have you in the class today, David. Thank you so much for making the time and coming and presenting to the class.
Thank you for inviting me.
And, you know, as you can see, ML and AI, the thing of the day, and probably quite a few more years to come. So I am myself personally very curious to learn and hear what David has to share with us today. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, David. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you, Dolphin. It's good to see you all, and thank you for welcoming me here today. So we're going to run through ML and AI and product management, but also want to talk a bit about product management in general from a business context. So we're going to go through that. We'll go through the concepts in a second, but first a bit about me. So you may have noticed that my accent is more American. So I'm originally from the United Kingdom. So I was based in the UK for most of my career, but I also lived and worked in Australia for 7 years, head of innovation, various different product roles. I've been here in the US for about 2 years. So my focus has been in product management. I've been working in tech for about 28 years, and I've been in product management for about 15 of those years. I've been in leadership for about 12 years, or at least at a director level. So I've been for all the different roles, help desk, fixing printers, fax machines, and all the way up to the biggest architecture for SharePoint environments in all of Europe. So a very diverse career. So on that, we'll get straight into it. So these are some of the areas we're going to cover today. So I'm going to give you an introduction to ML and AI in the context of product management and a bit of background about ML and AI. The anatomy of a product delivery group. So there are many different components to product delivery. It's not just product managers. Obviously, there are engineering teams and stakeholders and various other groups. So we're going to talk about that as well. Then we're going to talk about dealing with stakeholders because that's critical to your success. A lot of people undervalue the importance of being good with stakeholders. But in product management, we're in the business of relationships. Despite what people may think, it is a technical role. We have technical product managers, but everybody should know how to deal with stakeholders and manage good relationships. Then we'll talk about ROI. Use case management, future product management, and then we'll move to questions. Okay, so it's going to be an interactive session. So I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. I'm going to give you some options and just put your hands up based on what you think the correct answer is. Okay, so the birth of machine learning. So I'm going to talk about AI and machine learning separately because they are used differently in business and you have to work with them differently. They have different benefits and pros and cons. So we're going to go through that. Really important you understand the pros and cons, how to implement that in product development. So starting with machine learning, what was the first decade that machine learning was used in business? Not invented, used in business. So if you think of the 1950s, give me a show of hands. Anyone think 1950s? Nope. 1980s? We got 4 or 5 for 1980s. 2000s? A lot more for 2000s. 2020s? No one for 2020s. Okay. The answer is 1950s. So you may be very, very surprised. A lot of technology that comes to market comes a lot sooner than you think, but used in a very limited capacity. That's an important thing about technology. There's a concept called, or there's a chart called the Gartner Hype Curve. Is anyone familiar with the Gartner Hype Curve? I encourage you to look it up. So Gartner released, they call it it's changed the name now, Gartner Hype Cycle. So it's a cycle. And they have, effectively, the idea is that when new technology comes to the market, it kind of goes for a curve. So there's the peak of expectations, the bloating of expectations. Something comes to the market, businesses are like, wow, this is going to change the world. It goes up like this. And then it drops when they the drop of realization, or the trough of realization, they call it. We're like, oh, well, the technology is not really doing what we thought it would do. We just blew all this money. It's not as good as we thought. And then you get the plateau of productivity, which is when the technology starts to become effective. That entire process can take 10, 15, 20 years. So this is why a lot of people are surprised that a lot of the technologies we use today have actually been around for decades, but they haven't been effective or strategic enough to be of real value at a much wider level. But other things did happen during those decades, so you weren't entirely wrong. American Express started machine learning in the 1980s. FinTech, or financial technology, is an early adopter of most technologies. Property technology is a bit slower, a lot slower. It's one of the laggards when it comes to innovation, adopting new technology. For example, construction architecture is still 50 years behind. The technology hasn't really changed in construction the last 50 years. It has kind of some areas, but mostly hasn't changed a great deal. So American Express did a lot of pioneering with machine learning to detect fraudulent transactions back in the 80s. In the 2000s, big data came along. Computational power increased significantly. That was a limitation in the 50s. There wasn't enough computational power to run these complex algorithms. We started to see that in the year 2000 and there forwards. And in 2020 is when we really start to hit that plateau of productivity that I spoke about. So now we're really seeing a lot of adoption of machine learning, specifically AI, but particularly machine learning, and some of these areas. So reinforcement learning is one of the concepts of machine learning. So typically when you create a machine learning model, you train it very specifically based on your use case and based on the data you give it. And you can't just change the data whenever you feel like it. That's an entire development process. Reinforcement learning is a way to keep training a machine when it makes a mistake. So that's a very important capability that all of the CTOs are asking about right now. I was asked about this last Friday by one of our CTOs. Very important. Federated learning. So typically machine learning models, they operate on their own platform. They have an ops platform. There's a few in the market based on Azure, AWS, and some other platforms. But they're not federated. They operate independently on one platform. So federated machine learning is a new thing. It's growing very quickly. And that allows you to train models from multiple different platforms. So I'm sure you guys have heard of federated technology before. It's just the concept of connecting different systems together to distribute the processing, or to federate different organizations or data sets or data lakes or enterprise platforms. Explainable AI, this is really important. ML. This is AI and ML. It's changed me the words used sometimes. Explainable AI, from a machine learning point of view, you know what you're putting into the model and you know what's coming out, but no one's going to explain to you why it came out that way. But the business want to know, why am I getting this result? How reliable is it? And measuring reliability is super important. That is the most important thing you're going to get asked when it comes to machine learning. Is it reliable? Is it accurate? The answer is no, never 100% accurate, but it should be somewhere between 80 to 95% accurate. The closer you get to accuracy, to 100%, obviously the better. So that's particularly important. Okay, so now we're going to talk about ML versus AI in terms of the differences. So we spoke about when machine learning started. Now, does anyone here know what machine learning does better than AI? So structured data. Do you think that machine learning does a better job of structured data than AI? So basically, it's one or the other. It can't be both, right? So either it's machine learning does it good or AI does it good. They don't both do it good. So from a ML versus AI perspective, do you think the structured data is better suited to ML or AI? Put your hands up for ML. Go on over here. Large data sets, do you think that's better suited to machine learning or AI? Put your hands up for ML. Okay, explaining outputs, ML, AI, which is better at it? No one knows. Pattern recognition, what's the best way to do that, ML or AI? ML, okay. So I'm just going to assume everybody else was AI. You didn't put your hand up, ML. Okay, so these are the answers. Structured data, large data sets, ML is great for. Explaining outputs and pattern recognition, not so much. So that may be confusing because people know that ML is good for forecasting and this kind of thing. That's not the same as pattern recognition. Pattern recognition is looking at data and finding a pattern when you don't necessarily understand the data when you first start looking at it. Machine learning absolutely depends on strong, good, well-governed data. You have to have a very strong data set. Your schema has to be on point. You can't change the schema. The attributes have to be consistent throughout. So when you train a model, you can't just start putting in the wrong date format or change from strings to integers or anything like that. It has to be very, very well defined and it has to stick. And every time someone comes along and says, hey, I'd like to add one more attribute. Data labels, for example, data labels are machine learning. That's a way to say this is important data that you're going to learn from and respond to. That's called a data label or labeling data. that has to be consistent. And if you change it, you've got to go through the process of re-engineering that entire software development cycle. On the other hand, AI does a really good job, and we'll come to that as well. Large data sets. I don't know how many of you worked with large language models. You may have heard of tokens. So if you ever worked with the API for ChatGPT or Google Gemini, used to be Google Bard, you know that there's a concept of tokenization. So tokenization is how much data you send to the model and it returns to give the answer that you're looking for. There's a cost associated to that, which can be very high sometimes, but also a limitation to it. There's only a certain number of characters that you can send to a large language model before it kind of freaks out and falls apart. And that's a really big problem for businesses, particularly as most of our data is in enterprise data platforms, data lakes, and enterprise data platforms with terabytes and more of data flowing into a single table. Okay, so we'll go to what does AI do better than ML? So flipping a question this time, now looking at AI instead. Unstructured data, do you think that AI does that better than ML? Put your hands up, AI works well with unstructured data. Okay. AI works well with large data sets, yes or no? Anyone think AI, you guys are listening, it's good. Sentiment analysis, is that better for AI? Put your hands up if you think it is. Okay. Pattern recognition, is that better for AI? Okay, a few hands. So here's the answer. So I just spoke, everything is a yes. So AI, and it's great we have these different options, right? Because in business, you're going to work with structured data and unstructured data. Structured data is, for example, a database of properties, right? That's structured data. You've got first line, second line, zip code, sign, and so forth. Unstructured data is like survey data, client sentiment. What do you think of our services? That's unstructured data. It's harder to interpret with computers. So large language models, AI, Gen AI, does a really good job with unstructured data, which we'll come to. It's exceptionally good at it, in fact. Large data sets, not so much. So there are limitations when you use a large language model. So for example, right now, ChatGPT can support up to 64,000 characters per call to its API. Google Gemini have just gone up to 1 million about a week ago, which is astonishing, quite frankly. No one thought they were going to get that far that quickly. But you can put 1 million characters or 1 million tokens into, it is about 3 characters per token, something like that. It changes depending on the model. You can put that into, and that's important because a database is big. You know, it's not one or two documents. A lot of times we're abstracting data from 1,000, 2,000 documents simultaneously in a business. You know, you've got to scale these things very large when you work in business. When you experiment on your home laptop, it's not like business. You know, we're running terabytes of data into these models all the time. So you need to have that scalability. That has been a massive limitation of large language models. It's interesting that Google are ahead, but the quality of their model, in my opinion, is not as good as ChatGPT, for example. GPTs, I think they stand at 128,000 tokens right now. They're super important when working with data. Sentiment analysis. So sentiment analysis, one of the things that AI does really, really well is it acts like a human being, right? I don't know if you've had a conversation with ChatGPT about the end of the world from computer robotic domination. It's an interesting conversation. You should try it. So it feels like a very human conversation. And that's really important when you're trying to work with communications and corporate functions. You know, being able to summarize a document in human terms. If you, for example, get 600 responses in a survey and you want to know, well, it's from one building. So say that you're leasing a building to an occupier. You want to know if and you're maintaining their building, you do reception services, you fix the lights, you fix the coffee machines. What do they think of the services I'm providing as a business? You might get 10,000 replies across a portfolio, you know, because you manage thousands of properties across the country. We do. I need to, and I've surveyed all these people. I want to know, out of all these survey responses, what is the general sentiment? Are they happy? They're not happy? Is there a particular problem that's bothering them? For a human being to go through that is going to take a very, very long time. And they're probably going to miss some things. And it's going to cost a fortune because the humans cost a lot more than computers when it comes to computation, right? Because they're salaried, computers are not. So you have to consider all the pros and cons from that regard. That's where sentiment analysis comes. Before, computers can never do that. You can never say to a large language model, do they like my services? You can literally say that now and it will give you a response. So really good at sentiment analysis. Pattern recognition. What I mean by pattern recognition is going back to the example I gave, is there a pattern of problems in my portfolio? So for example, am I really bad at maintaining elevators? Is my reception services bad? Is concierge not up to scratch? It will find those patterns. I did an interesting experiment where I took all of our data from our entire national portfolio in the United States and I gave it all the work order information. So work order information is when someone calls up and they say, look, the coffee machine's broken, it's too hot, it's too cold, elevator's broken or whatever. I said, in all these portfolios, and this is almost every city in the US, there's about 5,500 rows of data. Tell me what is the thing I should be most concerned about. They found an elevator in Las Vegas. They said, this is the thing you should be most concerned about. And it did a very methodical analysis of that. And it did that in about 3 seconds. And he said, the elevator is a health and safety risk. It breaks, right? That can be pretty bad. People are in it. And it's been broken for a long time. It's not serviced enough. So he did pattern recognition. He determined, based on all the data, the trends of all the different assets. And based on this asset information, he said, this one is trending. Pattern here is it's going to fail at some point. For proactive predictive maintenance, which is very important in real estate, that's really important, that kind of capability. We have a lot of security software on our commercial laptops, our corporate laptops. So it's just telling me that I did something wrong. Okay, so AI goes mainstream. So this is specifically around generative AI. When and why did generative AI become strategically critical to businesses? And to be sure, it is strategically critical to most businesses, particularly large ones, very important. So we've got a few options here. 1998, 2013, 2020, 2022. So this is for Gen AI. So if you think that Gen AI become critical to businesses in 1998, give us a show of hands. No one. One. Okay, 2013. Okay, 2020. 2022. Yeah, a couple of hands. Okay, the answer is 2022. See, completely opposite. So to be sure though, it's been around since about 2013, AI. Gen AI specifically, but no one's using it because it wasn't very good. But what happened in November 2022? ChatGPT went to market and they gave public access to the first large language model of its kind. That is when all the news coverage, all the media coverage made all the CEOs and all the CEOs, but most of the CEOs in the country around the world look up and say, oh, this is probably important. We should probably invest in this and understand it. And then lots of companies started to invest and they started to understand and realize that there's real benefits to using Gen AI in business. So specifically, it was the launch of ChatGPT, at least for me, and for the businesses I work with, huge amount of interest at that point. And now it's literally, I would say, 50 to 60% of all of our technology budgets are going into Gen AI and machine learning. So it's really growing. It's a very big field. I don't think there's a single technology product we're developing right now, we're developing hundreds, that doesn't have some AI ML component to it. And all of that was because of what happened in November 2022. So as I say, AI was around before that, but that was when it really hit. I'm sure all of you heard the news when GPT came out, right? So that reverberated through businesses as well. It wasn't just, you know, home users and the press. Okay, so in summary, machine learning AI serve different purposes. So as I mentioned, machine learning is really good with structured data. It's very good at, and I'll give you some use cases later, it's very good at doing very prescribed tasks and very quickly as well. The large data sets is particularly important. AI is very good at doing more human-like tasks, but also it can process data. But right now, Gen AI is more suited to some of these cases we'll go through later. Doesn't handle large data sets too well right now, but that will change over time. So we've been through the pros and cons. Understand differences is crucial, making sure you choose the right tool. And the last question, public awareness and sentiment can drive strategic decisions in business. So that has been true. Remember, I don't know if you probably, I worked during the Y2K bug. So everyone believed that in the year 2000, all computers around the world would fail and planes would fall from the sky because computers were not designed to have clocks that could record the millennium 2000. They believed it would go from 1999 back to 1990 and all the planes would fall out of the sky. And they paid people, including myself, a lot of money just to sit in buildings in London to midnight just in case the world falls apart. And, you know, nothing happened. So, but it was the public awareness and sentiment of this problem that exploded it. It just went out of control. Companies do pick up on that and do invest in it. So that's an important thing to consider. So one of this is an interesting one. Amazon was one of the first early adopters of machine learning in 1998, and it boosted their sales and customer engagement. Look at Amazon now. Well, the recommendations are pretty good. So they were the first to use recommendation engines using machine learning. We use them now. We're actually building one ourselves at CBRE. So it's really interesting to see how far back machine learning was used in business and being successful as well. Some of the costs around large language models. Training large language models such as GPT costs, do you guys think, give me a show of hands, do you think it costs less than 100,000 to train a model? Less than 1 million? Less than 2 million? Just to train it? Less than 2 million? Less than 3 million? Less than 4 million? Over 4 million? Okay. So this was not to build it, it's just to train one model. Okay. It wasn't to build it, because they didn't release that information. So it cost them over $4 million to train ChatGPT 3.5. So we're on 4 at the moment, and 4.5 is on its way. Every time they release an update, it's about that amount of money that it costs to train a model. So the reason that's important is because most companies aren't going to spend $4 million. So we are dependent on these organizations to use their large language models. So that's why it's reliable and safe to investigate those models and to work with them and to understand them, because most of them are going to be around for a while. And it's not the kind of thing where you're going to get bespoke language models. Well, strictly that's not true. Some people are doing that, but it's very expensive and you need a lot of money for that. So going back to Microsoft, Microsoft invested $1 billion in OpenAI, ChatGPT. They then integrated GPT into Bing, and the GPT app on your phone, whenever you do an internet search, it uses Bing. In infrastructure, how much does it cost for them to maintain infrastructure? I think it's on a monthly basis, I said, right? It's a monthly basis. Each month, or each year, sorry, yearly, what is the cost? Do you think it's $1 million, $1 million or less? $10 million or less? $100 million or less? $500 million or less? Over $500 million. Okay, this is how much it costs a year. $4 billion for Microsoft to maintain their infrastructure in order to serve chat, large language model, OpenAI, to their customers on the internet. It's the sheer number, because everyone who uses the internet can use AI, right? So it's how many people? That's a lot of people. That's a lot of concurrent connections. So we obviously, from our point of view, we're not search engine gurus, so we'd have to worry about those costs, but there is still cost to all businesses for using Gen AI that you need to consider. And there is infrastructure requirements to some degree, depending on how you deploy it. Okay, so we'll go through the anatomy of product team. Okay, so I mentioned stakeholders, but there's a lot more to it than that. So in a product team, we refer to them as scrum teams. I'm sure you're familiar with a scrum team. A lot of people think of a scrum team as the technical people, but the scrum team can also incorporate analysts and non-technical people as well. So scrum masters are responsible for managing their backlog. I'm not going to go into a great amount of detail because I'm sure you've seen this before. I'm just going to try and relate a bit more back to machine learning and AI. Scrum masters are important people. In reality, sometimes it's hard to understand what they actually do because there's a lot of crossover of product management. So as product managers, we write user stories, we groom the backlog, we do the refinements, you know, we see it through delivery, we solicit requirements. Technically, a scrum master is supposed to manage the backlog, but on a much more detailed level than a product manager. But sometimes it gets mixed up a little bit. And not all companies want to spend money on a scrum master. They see it as a luxury. So a lot of the times you end up, the product manager also being a bit of a scrum master as well. And it's not always a very well clearly defined role. It hasn't been around as long as you would think, actually. Developers are super important. So as product managers, developers are your main relationship in product development. Engineers, work with engineers. And in fact, that's what defines a good product manager. Is your ability to work with the engineering team, but also work really well with the business teams as well, your stakeholders. You should be able to solicit requirements. You know, what developers, without being stereotypical, what developers typically not excel at is those kind of stakeholder interactions, you know? They're very technical, they're very specific. You know, they can talk hours on, you know, an API, but no stakeholder wants to talk for hours on an API. Maybe some, but most, you have to have very short, pointed conversations with your stakeholders, not 4-hour conversations on Google Gemini APIs. So the role of us as product managers is to bridge that gap between the business and the engineers and to see that product delivery through that process. And the best product managers are the ones that do that effectively. There are technical product managers and non-technical product managers. Many product managers are like, I want to work on the business side. Others are like, I want to work on the technical side. The stakeholder management is absolutely critical. And also, so is working with engineers, because if you can't speak to them both, how are you going to communicate the requirements from a high level into detailed requirements for the engineers, which you do need to do? So that's the developers. Product owner. So product manager, does everybody know what the difference is between a product manager and a product owner? Do you guys know the differences? Put your hands up, you know the difference. I'm not going to ask you a question, don't worry. Okay. So a product manager typically drives the strategic roadmap of the product. So they work with the business to define the strategy, like what is the vision for the product? That is the typical role of a product manager. They don't normally get involved in creating user stories and backlogs and that kind of stuff. That's a product owner. So a product owner is supposed to be less strategic, slightly more junior to a product manager, but not by a lot. So the product manager will say to the product owner, this is the vision, these are the features we want to build. Now you go and put it into the backlog, work with engineers, refine it, create the stories, estimate the work, and then go to get it done. That's what's supposed to happen. But they're two different roles that cost money, and most organizations will just have product managers, and they'll also play the part of a product owner. So you'll drive the vision of the product working with a business, but you'll also create the stories and so on and so forth and everything I said for a product owner. But they are different roles. And I mean, they pay differently as well. So it's an important distinction. So product owners and then stakeholders. I want to talk about stakeholders. So the Scrum team, we've been through that. There are many other groups, and I'm going to show you some other groups as well. The stakeholders, really important. There are different types of stakeholders, like a lot of different types of stakeholders. You can't treat every stakeholder the same. If you're dealing with an executive, that's very different from dealing with operational stakeholders. So for example, if I'm building an analytics solution using GenAI, which we're actually doing right now, when I speak to the analytics users, they're quite technical. They're Tableau developers. They're building dashboards in Tableau, sometimes on the cloud in SaaS, sometimes on their desktop. But either way, they're quite technical. They're writing complex queries, SQL statements, they're connected to databases. They know what they're doing. When you deal with those people, that's definitely dealing with a vice president or executive that really just wants everything in like one paragraph, right? And then they make the decisions. They sign off the money. They're the sponsor. They're very different stakeholders. And typically, depending on your seniority in the company, you may or may not get access to the senior stakeholders. But if you ever do, it's very important to understand how you treat them. You know, it's more of a relationship and less work, but convincing them and influencing them is super important. When you do with ops guys, it's more detailed conversations. But everyone is your customer. I'll come to that in a second. So this is very hard. I'm not going to get too into this. I just want to kind of cover that very briefly just to say, because I'm always going to come back to stakeholders. Stakeholders, to me, are always the most important part of our role. Like whenever I hire people, I always do it based on how I think they're going to deal with stakeholders. You can train people technology. You can teach people technology, no problem. Teaching someone fundamental communication skills, like being confident, you have to learn those things over time. And some people just don't have it, you know. I'm sure everyone can learn it, but no one's born with it. Speaking about dealing with stakeholders, so let's talk a bit about dealing with stakeholders. Okay, so as I said, product managers are in a business of relationships. Understand our stakeholders is very important. And as I said before, everybody's a stakeholder. I didn't say that. So the reason I'm saying that is because everybody's a stakeholder, because I mentioned the engineering team. Yes, they're your colleagues, but they're your stakeholders as well. For example, I work directly with the head of engineering in my company. He's my stakeholder. I need something from him all the time. He needs something from me all the time. So really, we're both stakeholders to each other. So the definition of a stakeholder is somebody that you serve, someone that you're accountable to. So this is not industry standard. It's just my position on it. My position is treat everybody as a stakeholder, even vendors, you know, because you want to be successful. And the way you treat people really does influence how successful you're going to be. So this is a typical, this is not an exhaustive list, but this is a pretty typical setup of a stakeholder matrix in most companies. You have a program management oversight, if you're lucky. Not all companies are investing that right now. Program management teams, they make sure the money's there. They make sure the task's completed. They have a little project plan and they go through it. And they're actually very helpful and very useful. And you miss them if you don't have them, because that then becomes your responsibility as a product manager. And it is a lot of work to coordinate all these teams. Executive sponsor. Executive sponsor is a person that says, yes, I'm willing to spend $500,000, $1 million, $2 million, $300 million on this project. So we have to keep those people happy. You'll meet that person maybe if you do, or your leaders will meet that person maybe once or twice a month. They're in like steering committees and stuff. But it's very important to influence those people, whether it's you or your team as a whole. They're the ones that are signing off on that product. They're the ones that make sure it goes to the client. They're the client-facing people. So they're very important people. Business leadership team. So a lot of time you might think, oh, well, you might combine those business leadership and executive sponsor. Whilst they technically are part of the same team, in very large organizations, there are a lot of leaders. So we deal with VPs and senior directors and so on and so forth. We treat them slightly differently than business partners or ops, I mentioned. The ops guys, we have very specific questions. When we gather requirements, we do complex spreadsheets and, you know, pseudocode on SQL statements and stuff like that for the Tableau dashboards, if that's what we're working on. But a business leadership team, they know what they want to deliver. Like, I want these features and capability. I don't want to tell you about all the pseudocode to write the queries, but all of that comes from the business. You absolutely entirely depend on the business to your requirements. But there is a slight change to that, which I think I'll get into a bit later on. And then technology teams. I mentioned these guys are stakeholders as well. I'm including them here. Again, typical ones, information, cybersecurity, architecture, infrastructure. Architecture, infrastructure, and small companies can sometimes be the same group. In our company, they're two separate groups. Architecture is becoming more and more important, particularly in cloud-based solutions, because architects have to contribute to that as well. It's not like the old days where you could just put a server on your desk or in a data center. Nowadays, a lot of it is cloud, which means there's a lot more implications around security, because your data is leaving your company, whereas it used to be inside your company. Secure is much easier. We used to have what we call an air gap, which means there's a physical separation of our hardware from the outside world, particularly in defense and government and so on and so forth. But now everybody goes to the cloud pretty much. Engineering, we spoke about that, and UX and UI. So UX and UI is user experience and user interface. So that's what it looks like and how it operates from a user experience point of view. Very important as well. Corporate functions. So you may wonder why they're in there. Legal. Are there any regulatory issues? Is there any compliance issues you need to be aware of? When it comes to large language models, whenever you use GPT or even Google Gemini, it will say check because large language models can be wrong. I did an article on this. They hallucinate all the time. It's much better now. It's improving a lot. But hallucinations are inevitable. Hallucination means that it gives you a very convincing answer, which is wrong. Well, interesting experiment. You ask a large language model, as long as it doesn't violate ethics or you tell it to do something functionally it can't do, you ask a large language model to give you an answer, it will always give you an answer. It will never not give you an answer. That's how they're designed. So what happens if it gives you an answer, but it doesn't have the data to back it up? That's where hallucinations come from. You will always get an answer from generative AI. But you can generally rely on GPT and Google Gemini and NVIDIA and some of the other ones, but hallucinations do happen. So there are legal implications to that, right? What if I misinform an investor and they spend $10 billion on investment and it's completely wrong? Am I going to be liable? That's why you need the legal team. Compliance. Am I compliant? So for example, there are regulations, not many. We talked about this earlier. There are some regulations, but with existing compliance. So GDPR is a privacy policy in Europe, very important. It relates to Gen AI in terms of how you move data around. For example, we had to face into that recently. And there's other regulatory considerations to be had as well. That's why you need the compliance team. Always be compliant. Internal comms. Everyone wants to know about what's going on with Gen AI in business as well, not just in university. All the people that don't work in AI want to know what's going on in AI and how do I get into it. So internal comms is really important. Particularly when I mentioned earlier, you really need the business to work with you all the time in any kind of product role. So getting them excited about what you're doing is going to help you to do that. So that's why internal comms is important. And then finance, someone's got to pay for it, right? So the finance team will help us to get the business cases raised. I literally submitted one today and get the money and the funding and pay everyone to come in and do all these jobs. You know, there's data science teams, there's engineering teams, there's product managers, product owners, there's many, many roles that have to be funded in every single product. And that's what the finance guys are for. So does anyone here know what ROI stands for? Excellent. Good. I'm glad that you all know that word. Okay. Good. So return on investment, so, so important. Measuring ROI is so incredibly important. It will be the life or death of a product, your return on investment. Nobody wants to waste money on something that doesn't do anything. So you already answered the question correctly. So there's different types of ROI when it comes to all products, all services, not just technology, not just AI, all products and all services. So hard revenue is the best type of ROI. If you can prove you can make money, you'll probably get signed off straight away. Our business cases go through no problem with good ROI, particularly if we're making more money than we're spending in the first year. But that's very unusual because businesses need all kinds of technologies to operate for efficiency reasons, time saving, and so on and so forth. Very few of the technology products that people build can have hard revenue. Efficiency and time saving, way more common. ML and AI does a great job of that. I mentioned the surveys. So if I was trying to do a business case for looking at pattern recognition or occupier sentiment in a survey, that would be a great ROI for that, efficiency and time saving. Competitive advantage, that is the unicorn right now of AI and ML when it comes to getting funding for these different products, because everybody is doing AI. All of the competitors are doing AI. It's not a question of if you should, it's when you should. If you're not doing AI, you're already losing ground to your competitors as a business. It's so critical. And we watch each other. We watch each other like hawks. We watch all our major competitors to see what they're doing, what are we doing, who's ahead. And our clients come back to us and tell us. They tell us if we're doing well and how we stack up. Super important. So when you put that in a business case, it tends to work out pretty well as well. And attracting and retaining clients. So that is not the same as hard revenue. Hard revenue is I'm going to make money from existing clients or new clients, and you can prove it. You have a metric or a value you can put against it. Attracting and retaining clients means I'm going to add 20 new clients again by this year or 2000 or whatever it's going to be. So that's also a significant driver as well. So challenges in tech ROI. So some of the challenges of ROI in tech, and we struggle with this every year, is tech generally doesn't close deals. So because most of the roles that you do in your future are going to be in industries other than technology, whether it's real estate, insurance, finance, automotive, manufacturing, whatever, education. So whichever industry you're in is not going to be directly tech related unless you work for the Googles or Microsoft, and many people do. So in those situations, your ROI has to reflect whatever that business is doing in their industry, right? So in my industry, in commercial real estate, that's making money from leasing, selling buildings, maintaining buildings, that kind of thing. That's how we make money. Technology isn't really in a closed deal. You can't go into a pitch. If I want to get Bank of America to let me manage 400 of their properties, telling them that I can do really good dashboards is probably not going to win a deal, right? They want to know how you're going to maintain my business, where are you going to save me money, how are you going to lower my carbon footprint. These are the important things to occupiers in those spaces, not the tech itself. But it is important in the bigger picture, but it's not the one thing that's going to win the deal. So that's a challenge for us. And I always said this, technology is expensive. You have to find a way to get the money back on that. Uncompelling ROI will kill your product. Even if you've already built a product, seen plenty of products die that have been around for years. Even if you've got a product built, you invested millions of dollars in it, it could anytime they say, you know what, we're going to deprecate this product. Microsoft, other companies do all the time. So maintaining value is very, very important as well. So there are tech metrics that we can use when we're trying to convince people that we built something cool. Number of users and concurrent users, the usual usage things that you would see, number of report downloads, digital transactions, and then competitive advantage from a tech point of view. Because competitive advantage in a business tends to apply to your competitive advantage for the services you serve, real estate, so on and so forth, right? Technology helps you to be better at serving your service. Whereas competitive advantage in tech is saying we have better tech than they do, specifically a better tech. So that is also something we can use in business cases as well. This is something that's scaring a lot of CTOs right now. Measure and verify. So what they're saying is we want to measure the work that you've done and verify the value you said you're going to deliver. For a long time, people put all these benefits at the beginning of the year to say, I need to get $4 million and my ROI is going to be $5 million. But whilst they do check at the end of the business case, they don't really get into a lot of, at least in my experience, they don't really go into a lot of detail. No one really asked the hard questions. Did you make the money back? A lot of time they didn't. They don't really get into it. So measure and verify is continually measure the ROI you're returning and then verify that there were savings and money was brought back into our business or we, you know, whatever the benefits that we listed in the business case. So that's what I measure. So that's really important. A lot of companies are coming down on that. I gave an example here of predictive maintenance, energy sustainability. So we have a service in our company where we call it Smart FM. We have IoT, you guys from the IoT, Internet of Things. So we have all these sensors in buildings that measures like energy usage, water, electricity, off people in certain rooms. And then we adjust the settings of certain plant equipment, devices in the building, air conditioning, energy, lighting, heating, that kind of thing, depending on where people are, how they're using it. So smart buildings, you know, smart intelligence. But in reality, how much money have you saved on your utility as an occupier, as a building owner? How much money have I saved on my utility bills? Did I save on electricity? Did I save on gas? You'd be surprised how many people can't answer that question. It's like, well, we put a product in there, but is it actually making money? Is it saving you money? So that's where a lot of companies stand up and say, well, let's verify some of this stuff. We were caught up in the high expectation, and let's verify it. Okay, so use case management. Super important. Every single product is the result of a use case. That's where it all starts. Use cases are the seeds of products. And with AI and ML, it presents a slightly different challenge because it's such a not a well-understood technology that is difficult for stakeholders to tell you what they want from it. And they shouldn't do that anyway, right? Most products are built to solve a problem. But in certain cases, so before AI and ML, there was robotic automation and some other technologies that came to like big data. It presented unique opportunities that weren't available in kind of standard technologies. So as product managers, our responsibility to help draw out, solicit those requirements based on the capabilities of technology. This is where product managers are so vital when it comes to machine learning and AI, because it's going to be our job understanding the underlying technology, mapping that to the business need, asking the right questions. What is the business problem? And they're saying, well, maybe AI, I did this literally, one of my colleagues here, Ashley, was me. We did this recently last week where we spoke to a stakeholder in our legal team. We were asking the questions like, what are your problems? What do you need to do? And I'll go for one of those use cases now. They didn't understand the tech. But once they give us the problem, we're able to relate the tech back to the problem that they're talking about. So it's super important. And again, innovative. So once it solves a problem, a lot of organizations have innovation quotas. What that means is when you have a new client, you agree with that client that you do some innovation throughout the term of the contract, not in like all businesses, but if you have long-term contracts with clients. So for example, a typical lease in a commercial property is sometimes 10 years. That's a long relationship. It's a long contract. So we have what we call a master services agreement, MSA, where we commit to certain things. We will innovate X number of times each year. So this would help any emerging technology will help to alleviate some of those quotas when it comes to innovation. And there are penalties for not doing that. So it is commercially important. So this is absolutely nowhere near a full list of all the capabilities. It's not exhaustive at all. This is like five or six, whatever it is. there are probably 300 use cases we're working with right now in my company across ML and AI, across all the divisions as well. But I want to give these, some of these are generic, but I'll give you some use cases. So machine learning, I mentioned, is good with big data, data standardization. Most companies have really bad data. They have data from all different systems, different countries, different places in the world, legacy systems, and it just doesn't go together very well. So information architecture is a real problem. AI, ML can help with data standardization. So for example, we have different property types. We have, so in commercial real estate, there's industrial, retail, and office. But if you go down the level, there's also an office in a lab, an office in a warehouse, an office in a university. So we only care about office. So we use ML to say, well, if it's got the word office in there, and then based on this other feeding, this learning we've given you, or this training we've given you, pick out the ones, map it to office, map it to retail, map it to industrial. When you're dealing with hundreds upon hundreds of thousands or millions of rows of data, super powerful. But traditionally, some human being would have to go through that, or you have to build some very expensive system. Machine learning does that really well. We use that a lot. So you create these modular capabilities of machine learning to fix data. So data, that's just one example. There are many examples. Predictive data entry. This is actually quite powerful. Machine learning does this pretty well. So for example, I mentioned work orders earlier. So we have, I'll give you actually a really good scenario. So in medical services, if somebody says a power's out, when they create a work order, when they say a problem in my building, a power's out, we call someone no matter what time of night or day to send them there to fix it. Because if it's a medical facility, that could be a heart monitor, could be a respirator. You can't let the power go out, right? Turns out most of the time it's a coffee machine or a printer or something like that. But we can't differentiate because somebody put the wrong problem code in. They just chose power outage, the coffee machine. So we use machine learning to say, did you mean? It checks what they type in the description and it makes a recommendation. Do you mean coffee power or this power, that power? And it means we'd have to get technicians out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, we don't have, these are called blue light services, is what we call them. They're very critical. And technology typically is 24/7 for those kind of services. Very applicable to medical. Client sentiment. So we spoke about this. I won't go through this. Occupier sentiment surveys. That's just one type. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever used Copilot for Teams. It's in preview. We've been using it for a while. When I have a meeting, and sometimes my team will know how heated those meetings can get, I can ask AI, what was the sentiment of the meeting? What did people, and it'll give me a really good description. You know, he was pretty angry. This guy, yeah, he wasn't happy at all. And he's a nice guy. And it'll give you really good, interesting information like that. And it'll take notes and things and it will feed you back. So that sentiment can actually be very powerful, particularly if you missed a meeting and you wanted to see. And not everybody can judge human behavior very well. Like you may think someone's being cool when they're really angry. So AI does that better than some human beings, in my opinion. Real-time device management, we touched on this with smart technology for IoT. So as data comes in, for example, let's say that there's a group that were in a meeting room, they leave the meeting room, the sensors pick up that no one's in the meeting room, it immediately cuts off electricity in that room or reduces it or whatever. That's actually a lot harder to do than people think, but that capability is difficult to do without AI and ML. Because typically what happens is you create rules when you don't have AI and ML. With AI and ML, you don't need to create rules. Tell it what to do. If that room is empty, turn the power off. It will just know to do it, right? So it's very interesting from that regard. So those kind of workflows and automations are way more powerful now with Gen AI and ML, but particularly Gen AI. Data extraction and interpretation. So data abstraction is abstracting data from documents. So for example, contract management. Let's say that I'm a contract firm. I've got 10,000 contracts and I need to know if all of those contracts have the same clauses in them for a given situation. Am I going to go for every single one? You would have done normally, but now I can load up all those documents, extract the information from them, and just pick out what I need to know for those clauses. That is probably, in my company, that's the biggest use case right now, by far. We do that a lot. And in fact, I'm having weekly, almost daily conversations about it. And then interpretation. So summarization interpretation. So I use this all the time personally with ChatGPT. That's my preference. So this is, for example, here's 20 pages of data. So it could be a contract, it could be a RFP, request for proposal or response to a proposal. Summarize what they want. Summarize how I should respond. And then you can reinforce that learning as well. You can point your own corporate domain data at that machine learning model, and it's called fine-tuning, also reinforcement learning. Say, this is more information about my business that large language models wouldn't have. Now give me an answer based on what you know about my business and what's in this document. So that's what interpretation and summarization can be used for. We'll just summarize this into one paragraph for an article that I'm launching or something like that. That's very powerful as well. And actually, fine-tuning is important because right now, when you train a large language model, it's called a corpus of data. They're training with books, websites, all kinds of data from all around the world. I mean, literally has the vast knowledge of the whole world in these large language models, but that's called a corpus they're training with. But it doesn't have to specifics to your business, only has what's public. So if you want to train a model, we have this concept of fine-tuning, which says, in addition to what you know out there in the world, here's all the information about my business, so you can answer better for my business. That's called a corpus of data. So that's where fine-tuning reinforcement learning comes in as well. So the future of product management. I mean, I'm not a mystical person, so I can't tell you the actual future. I don't have a crystal ball or anything. I'll give you what I think is trending right now. And what I can tell you is where product management came from. It didn't exist about 15 years ago. We called it, so product managers are called SMEs, subject matter experts. That's what we used to call product managers. And I ran engineering teams at the time, and we would call them product teams now, UI, UX, that kind of thing. But product is so important right now. Businesses realized very quickly that they weren't getting what they asked for. And actually, this is where Agile came from. So before Agile, there was this concept of waterfall. So waterfall was, I'm going to build a product, I'm going to give you a whole car, and you tell me if it works. 3 years later, I'll give you a car, doesn't work. Okay, go back to the drawing board. That's a long time to wait for something to fail. So Agile was designed to say, well, here's a functional wheel, here's a functional steering wheel, here's a functional pedal. Test it. If it works, we'll start working on the next thing, or we'll fix it. That's Agile. It's iterative development. So the idea, so MVP, minimum viable product, prototyping, proof of concept, all very important terms, because you're delivering iterative capability through product management, agile development. So that's super important. That wasn't that important 10, 15 years ago. And stakeholders were like, I want to get a product and we'll come back in a year or two. And this is not what they asked for. And it's bad for everybody. It's a very difficult conversation, trust me. So agile development means that we can give our stakeholders something that's working and make sure we're heading in the right direction. That is the fundamentals of agile development. From a principal point of view, that's something that's changed a lot. And from an AI ML perspective, it's even more important because this technology is evolving so quickly. I mentioned that Google Gemini is up to 1 million tokens from what was 3,400 a year ago. It's a massive leap. So the technology is evolving quickly. To stay ahead of it, we need to be iterating through Agile all the time. So businesses understood that, but they also understood who is best placed to run this Agile process. The answer is product managers. They are best placed to run this process. Because they understand the business, they understand the stakeholders, they understand engineering, they understand UX, they understand UI, they understand testing, they understand go-to-market. All these things we understand, and we're really the only roles that understand all of that together and have all these different relationships. We're able to deliver on these capabilities. That's something that has only really started coming around, and even roles have been created to this end. So I'm going to go through these one at a time. So I remember there was no such thing as a chief of product, 15 years ago, then like VP of product. So all of the executive roles that typically you would get for chief technology officer, chief information officer, all these kind of things, we now have those all for product as well. When that happens, it means this is going to stick around. So a huge ecosystem. And it takes some time to convince engineering teams they need product managers. But once you start helping them, once you start showing them value that we bring, they can't live without it. It becomes a vital component. Everything that we do, product management. And also, a lot of companies learn the hard way, right? They have failed products. Especially with Waterfall, that's a good example. It took years before people, years and tens of hundreds of millions of dollars of failures, get to a point and say, yeah, this isn't working, this whole Waterfall thing. How else can we do it better? And that's where Agile came from. Same with product management. Companies thought, it's not working for us. What's our strategy? Where are we going? The business is screaming. That's not what I asked for. It's not what I told you. And normally, because we just don't understand what they're saying. Engineers struggle to understand what the business is asking. They're all ones and zeros in code. They don't care about commercial real estate. Well, they may care, but it's not going to be their forte. So that's our specific skill set that we bring to the table. So a bit about what I think makes you a better, well-rounded product manager definitely more successful. And 100%, if you go into an interview and you exhibit some of these capabilities, they will be noticed. The first thing is confidence. So be confident in what you're saying. If you're studying like you are now for product management, it's a very interesting field. It's a combination of relationships and technology and so on and so forth. But be confident in what you do. And whenever you go into those, dealing with stakeholders as well, try and be confident. Understand the business. The main knowledge is critical. One of the great things about working in tech is you can work in any industry. If I'm a pilot, I can only work in airlines, right? You don't work in insurance when you're a pilot. But when you work in tech, you can work. I worked in all kinds of every conceivable industry over the last 28 years. So that gives us a much broader capability when it comes to living and working in different countries. I've lived and worked in 3 different continents, many different domains. But it does make it harder for us because then we have to understand the domain that we're in, the industry we're in, much faster. Everyone else has been there for 20 years. They know how commercial real estate works, or insurance, or finance. You just got there a year ago, and you're supposed to learn everything they've known for 20 years? Yes, you do. To a point, enough for you to help them drive product strategy. So very important to learn the business that you're getting into. When you go to an interview, talk about their business, do your research, understand their industry, understand their business. Very important. Stakeholder management as well. Always be respectful of stakeholders, or everybody is, well, I would say, but particularly stakeholders. That's where the money comes from. They're the people that need to sign off on your product. Understand that people are difficult, can be difficult. We have some very interesting, I've been in this company for 10 years. I've worked across all of our businesses around the world. This is the hardest stakeholders I've worked with, in terms of they're quite technical. They make very good money. They high revenue. So they're very demanding, kind of very demanding. So we have a lot of back and forth. I don't want to say conflict. Does happen. How are you going to deal with conflict? Ask yourself that question. You know, if you're, lots of people start introvert and become extrovert. I'm not suggesting you do that, but be prepared for some challenges and some difficult conversations, and learn actual ways to deal with it. That there are strategies you can use to deal with conflict. It is going to come up at some point. Always, and conflict doesn't mean screaming and shouting. That's not conflict in business, not a war. How do you get to an agreement without getting into an argument is the real skill, is the unicorn of conflict management. I always ask this question as well. I'm interviewing, what would you do in this situation if you're in a conflict? How would you resolve it? You know, so that's another thing as well. And it's not just with stakeholders. It's with your engineering colleagues. It's with the UX team. It's with your bosses. It's with your subordinates. There's always going to be something you disagree with. Getting, negotiating a resolution is the most important thing. So very, very important. So the summary from this point of view, product management is 100% around to stay, not going anywhere. I imagine it will break off and evolve into other things as well. It's a very lucrative industry as well. People do very well going straight into product management, particularly at this moment. Obviously with AI and ML, one thing I will say about the future, I do think the product management roles will diverge into specific technologies like product management, AI and ML. I think that will be the first. But in future, there'll probably be product managers for automated technology or insurance technologies. I mean, that does apply, like, do you have the experience in industry? But people, so for example, there are technical product managers and just product managers. They're two specializations. I think that's going to break out to even more specializations in the future for product managers. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on. But definitely a very good career decision, and better than it was for me when I started. It's much better for people now. Easy to get into, easier to learn. Lots and lots of opportunities. All right, I think we're on the hour. So thank you all for your time and listening. And I hope you had some value from this presentation. And thank you for inviting me.